Welcome to Sustainability Bridges, a URCIF podcast aimed at building bridges between policymakers, investors, academics, and civil society around the theme of sustainable investing. URCIF is the leading pan-European association promoting sustainable finance and sustainable investing at the European level. In this podcast, the Executive Director of URCIF will invite distinguished guests for a 30-minute conversation on current events shaping the sustainable investing community.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Victor Van Horn, and I'm the Executive Director of URCIF. For this episode, I'm honored and delighted to be joined by Mrs. Hortense Bioy, Global Director of Sustainability Research at Morningstar. Together, we are going to discuss about EU regulations such as the SFDR, MiFID II, and how those regulations are shaping and changing the sustainable investment market. Hortense, good morning and delighted to have you today on the podcast.
Good morning, Victor, and thank you for inviting me.
To get straight in, I think Morningstar is starting to build a bit of a reputation for itself as publishing regularly those reports on trends in the markets around SFDR, amongst other things. So I guess from your vantage point, looking at the market across Europe, what are the key trends you've identified doing this exercise now several times?
The trend, Victor, is pretty clear. I mean, we've been reporting increased demand for ESG and sustainable funds quarter over quarter, driven by a huge appetite from investors to mitigate ESG risk and climate risk in particular, or I should say increasingly, but also to support companies that have a positive impact on the environment and society at large. So I know in the past few months, there have been some criticisms. There's been some concerns around greenwashing. People also have talked about the performance of ESG, and also, as we know, some geopolitical events recently have also made some investors question about this trend. But I think, despite that, we expect the strong demand for ESG and sustainable products to continue in the coming years. And I think this strong demand will be supported by global ESG standards, new taxonomies, and regulatory reporting requirements, which will bring transparency and clarity about the investment options available to investors. As we know, there's this huge agenda in Europe. I mean, the EU is leading the way when it comes to sustainability with its Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation, SFDR, and taxonomy. But the UK and the US are also working on their own disclosure regulation for both issuers and investment products. And other countries have also their own disclosure measures underway. I know we may also talk about MiFID II, the MiFID II amendment, which I think is going to act as a catalyst. I will, I think, accelerate the demand for this type of products because financial intermediaries, financial advisors will have to ask their clients about their sustainability preferences in addition to their financial objective. As I said, I think this piece of regulation has really the potential to accelerate capital flows into sustainable and ESG funds. Now, in the US, I mean, if we want to talk about the US, I mean, that's a separate story, but it remains to be seen if the DOL, the Department of Labor, will make it easier for retirement plans to take into consideration ESG factors and invest in sustainable strategies.
Well, thanks for that. And indeed, I think we can see over the last couple of months in the US, the ESG acronym coming back into the political debate more forcefully than one might have anticipated. So, and I think that's a really interesting thing because you've mentioned the sustainability preferences, really the client perspective. Are you sensing that the ESG conversation is mostly about financial overperformance? That was a thematic that emerged very much during the COVID pandemic, that the ESG funds performed better from a traditional financial perspective. Or is really a lot of the conversations about we need to take a long-term perspective, and this is here to stay, and we need to start taking sustainability seriously in the investment process. Where do you see the conversation?
Clearly, for me, it's a long-term trend. In recent years, there have been a lot of studies done on ESG performance to demonstrate that investing sustainably doesn't necessarily mean sacrificing returns. This idea that there must be a performance trade-off when you consider ESG factors and when you focus on certain sustainability factors is a belief that still persists. And the recent underperformance of many ESG funds this year is used to prove that point. But, you know, interestingly, if I can mention a study that ESMA did recently, I think it published a study in May about fees and returns of ESG equity funds in 2019 and 2020. And they compared the ESG funds with non-ESG funds. And ESMA found that, I mean, something that we kind of knew, ESG funds are more oriented towards large cap stocks. They're more oriented towards developed economies. And there is a sectoral bias as well, you know, when you compare ESG to non-ESG funds. Perhaps the most interesting finding of the ESMA study is that even after controlling for all these differences, they found that ESG funds remain statistically cheaper and better performing than non-ESG peers. That's interesting, isn't it? And this is coming from, I believe, a non-biased organization. Now, I think what's very important to say to investors is that if they're investing in those funds, it's for the long term, right? And investors shouldn't expect ESG to thrive in every market environment. In fact, no investment strategy works all the time. ESG screens cause divergence from the market, which will inevitably lead to good performance in some environments and underperformance in others. But we find that ESG screens have led to resilience in down markets, even in brutal downturns like in March 2020. Morningstar and Sustainalytics have documented links between ESG and factors like corporate quality and financial health. So long term, there are reasons for investors to be encouraged about the prospects of ESG investments in their portfolio.
Okay, no, that's very interesting. And particularly one point I'd like to pick up on is interesting that ESMA concluded indeed that ESG funds were cheaper, because one of the themes you see emerging in the discussions around sustainable finances in ESG is, you know, this is very data intensive. There's a lot of expectations on asset managers to do engagement with the companies they invest in, which requires staff, expertise, resources, and somebody needs to pay for that at the end of the day. So it is interesting. Is that something you're picking up as well in the conversations and in the trends in the industry, that kind of it's, if you do it well, it will cost money, or is that too simplistic way of looking at it?
I think it really depends on the managers. I mean, we clearly, for a lot of managers, it's become a strategic priority. I mean, ESG data is bought for everyone to be used, right? So it's used by the analysts who come up with recommendations. It's used by portfolio managers to allocate capital. It's used by the engagement teams that are, you know, go and talk to the companies and they need data for that. They also talk to companies to get more data and better data. And it's used by, you know, the proxy voting team. So it's used by everyone. So it's, as we know, it's, I mean, the asset management industry is an industry that have good margins. I think they can take that cost. And if they do not invest enough in data, they don't invest enough in people, they know that they will lose, you know, some clients, right? So it's a competitive imperative at this point.
Okay, now that's very interesting. One piece of regulation you've already mentioned, and I know you've done several reports and look at it more closely, is the Sustainable Finance Disclosure Regulation. What's interesting there is if you talk to the policymakers designing it, they meant it to be a transparency framework. Yet quite a few people have started to use it as a classification system. Now, you've obviously looked very closely at the population of investment products in Europe that are following SFDR. Do you see a little bit of harmonization of these different categories? Is it homogeneous sets of products, or is it really kind of very challenging to find some common threads across those products in the different SFDR categories?
You know, as you said right at the beginning, and we've been following and examining those funds from the beginning, from the introduction of SFDR in March 2021. I think we're still seeing the same thing. I mean, as at the beginning, we're not seeing an homogenization of categories. As we know, the Article 8 category is broad, and it was broad from the beginning. What's interesting is the Article 9 categories are probably, it's probably the category that has evolved the most. I wouldn't say it's broadened, but clearly we've seen new strategies in that bucket, and one that comes to mind in particular is all these passive funds that track EU climate benchmarks. So I know there is a little bit of a debate in the industry about that. Should they really be Article 9? But I mean, this is really something that has taken off massively in the last year. So here I'm referring to passive funds that track Paris-aligned benchmarks, climate transition benchmarks, and we've seen a lot of existing passive funds that have switched indices to try, you know, to one of those indices, a type of indices. And now, I mean, it may surprise people to hear that these passive products now represent more than 10% of ESG passive funds. They achieved that in less than a year. I don't remember, I don't have the asset at the top of my head, but it's a lot of assets. So I think that shows that investors are really considering climate risk and climate opportunities more than ever before. And it's, I think going forward, this is certainly going to be something that is going to shape more strategies and all types of strategies, you know, even Article 8 strategies. We're seeing that more and more. Binding constraints, objective of reduced carbon intensity, 20%, 30%, you know, all types of thresholds or objective. It's interesting.
It's interesting what you say, because it's, on the one hand, if you look at the spirit of the regulation, there seems to be this idea that asset managers need to do a lot of due diligence in selecting what they put in their portfolio, which companies pass through those filters, satisfy the, you know, famous do no significant harm principle. And on the other hand, you see, as you say, the fastest growing segment seems to be passive index replicating funds, that where, you know, the selection seems to be done by the index provider rather than necessarily the asset manager. Do you think it's going to evolve like that? Is it a fair, you know, is it smart to have those two categories of products in the same bucket, or do you think some more granularity will need to emerge over time?
Just to specify that usually this discussion happens between the index provider and the asset manager. So it's not only the index provider deciding, oh, we're going to change these indices, or they are clearly offering new indices, but they are manufactured usually in close collaboration with fund providers. Now, I mean, maybe you're asking me to contribute to this debate, but those funds have a place in the Article 9 category. I don't know. They're clearly different. The portfolios, when you look at the holdings, are clearly different from other types of Article 9 funds. Yes, I mean, also, I know some people tend to think these are just low carbon strategies. So if you think, you know, low carbon, I mean, they would probably fit better in Article 8. Because they're not as ambitious, they're not investing in companies that provide solutions, you know, to the transition, which is what most Article 9 funds are trying to do, right? So there's clearly a difference there. So I don't know where this debate is going to go. I think that's probably up to the regulator, European regulator, as opposed to national regulator, to decide. Maybe one more thing. There's a distinction, of course, between climate Paris, Paris aligned benchmarks and climate transition benchmarks, because you're right, the latter, so the climate transition benchmarks, are allowed to invest in fossil fuels, right? And we know that because of the do not significant harm principle, some people do have an issue with, you know, these Article 9 funds holding fossil fuel companies.
Because that seems indeed to be the tension, that the climate transition benchmark seems to be focused on, let's take a broad set of the economy, knowing that the whole economy needs to change to achieve the climate goals, versus the approach of do no significant harm, where we know that some industries are going to face a struggle to comply with that burden, looking at the environmental objectives we set ourselves. So this tension seems to be always there. One of the other questions I had, which is I found very interesting from the regular reports you have published, is one of the objectives of policymakers was to have SFDR help the industry reorient capital in a different way. That's a stated policy objective. It's in there now. If you look at the very interesting data point you publish, is the top holdings of those funds, Article 8, Article 9 funds. It is still interesting to see that, as you say, these are many large cap companies that you would have expected in any good investment portfolio seeking to achieve financial objectives. At the beginning of this reorientation, do we think SFDR can do this reorientation, or does it serve another purpose?
So, as you said, you know, the objective of the EU Sustainable Finance Action Plan and SFDR is really to reorient capital flow towards sustainable activities. But we know that it's not going to happen overnight, right? It's going to take time because today the pool of sustainable companies is very small. And what we really want is that existing companies, especially the brown companies, we want those to transition and become greener. We want them to do less of the bad stuff and do more of the good stuff. So how can investors do that? Well, there are several ways, but maybe I can talk about two main ones. I mean, they can put pressure on those worse companies, you know, so that they transform their activities. And investors can use different tools to do that. We know they can use engagement, proxy voting, public statements, shaming, and praising. These are all valid strategies. So that's one way, putting pressure on the worst companies. Investors can also invest in the better and improving companies. So those are not completely green yet, but they are going in the right direction. Because they're investing in the right activities themselves. So it's not about the investors investing in the green companies, but the investors investing in the companies that are investing in the sustainable activities. So by investing in this sort of companies, investors are supporting them. They're also sending a signal to the market and to other companies that investors are happy to provide capital to those companies that are improving their activities. So there is an incentive for the worst companies to improve too. And I think for that, the analysis of CapEx is important. Investors need to know what sort of activities the companies they're investing in will focus on tomorrow, right? How the business model and operations will evolve so investors can support those companies that are going in the right direction. So again, as I said, this reorientation of capital will take time. And a lot of portfolios, and Article 9 portfolios in particular, are not green, but because they reflect the current economic reality. And we want these companies to improve. Bad scenario would be one where the pool of green and good companies remain small, and all sustainability-minded investors would want to invest in the same companies, because that would distort the market. That would create a bubble. And of course, governments have a crucial role to play in this reorientation of capital. They need to create the right environment to support this dynamic by introducing the right environmental and social policies.
it's very interesting. I think nearly every podcast participant we have had on the series has emphasized the role of governments and how the industry will gradually adjust. So it's interesting to see that thematic. One of the questions I have, then, you know, listening to this latest answer is, if you take a step back and look at the sustainable finance agenda that EU has rolled out, if you look at the SFDR, taxonomy, MiFID, a lot of that regulation seems to be focused predominantly on, at the end of the day, identifying the best companies out there, the best performers, and rewarding that. It seems that for now, there seems less attention to this question of how do we transform the bigger pool of assets, the bigger pool of companies, and what does this journey look like? Do you think that's a fair criticism to level at this agenda? Do you think it needs to evolve, or is that unfair in your opinion?
No, we need to evolve. I mean, I think it's really important to understand what you already own, you know, what your portfolio looks like today, and understand the companies you have in your portfolio today, so the carbon footprints, you know, the policies and things. But the direction of travel is perhaps more important, right? But it's more fuzzy, right? It means, you know, you sometimes have to rely on imperfect data, and you have to project. And I mean, we can talk about net zero. I mean, you know, a lot of people think it's a lot of guesswork, but you have to do it. You have to make some assumptions about where the world is going, what the science is telling us, and adjust to that. And that means, you know, you will make decisions on very imperfect data. So we hear often the criticism of, oh, this rating agency says this and this other rating agency says that, because it's complex, right? And they're looking at different things. Some are looking only at the past, some others are more forward-looking. I think investors need to understand that complexity. It's multidimensional. It's backward-looking as well as forward-looking. So yeah, and the regulators in all this will also need to also reflect that complexity. And so we when we educate investors, this is what we're trying to tell them, is that you need to use a combination of data, combination of metrics. You also need to do some qualitative analysis of the managers, because intentionality is very important. SFDR reflect that well, I think. It's really asking the manager, okay, what are you intending to do? Which I think is the right approach.
Okay, no, that's interesting. Yeah, you've just touched upon another very exciting topic right now amongst policymakers is ESG ratings, and indeed this idea that companies are being, the same company can be rated differently simply because providers take a different perspective. Is it risk, opportunities, backward looking, forward looking? But again, is that what do you think is going to happen there? If we take out the crystal ball, do you hear from investors that this ESG ratings are useful, or do you think over time that we may see a bit more focus on specifically on the E, the S, and the G with a bit more granular in-depth analysis?
The market wants, or investors want, simple metrics to consume, right? So this is why we have ESG ratings. But of course, ESG ratings reflect, you know, like a lot of different dimensions, which sometimes are in conflict, right? I think what's going to be interesting with the MiFID II amendment, people are going to be asked, what do you care about? You know, and they will have to be specific. Like, do you care more about the environment? Do you care more about social issues? So I think that's going to lead advisors, you know, towards certain different types of portfolios, right? And they will use ESG ratings, you know, which is the headline ratings you can find, but also they will also look underneath and they will look at other different types of metrics, right? So if a client cares about the environment, then they will look at, for example, carbon footprint, carbon intensity. They want to know also if the fund is on a good trajectory when it comes to the transition. So if the client cares more about social issues, then there will be social metrics that the financial advisor can use. There's going to be even more data available from next year. As we know, we're also starting to see more data coming in with the European ESG template. So yeah, I mean, it's going to be a matter of just picking and choosing the metrics that makes more sense for people.
Okay, well, thank you very much for spending time with us this morning and answering those very interesting questions. I think we can all agree this will keep us busy for the next couple of years as the market matures and evolves. But Hortense, for now, thank you very much.
Thank you, Victor.
It brings us to the end of this insightful conversation and the end of today's episode. Thank you very much for listening. Do not hesitate to like, follow and share this episode of Sustainability Bridges. EuroSIF will continue in the next episode to bridge the gap between the policymaking and the practice of sustainable investing with the help of distinguished guests. In the meantime, please visit our website and follow us on social media to stay tuned. See you next time for a new episode of Sustainability Bridges.